Astronomer Chris Impey tells us, cosmology is not always beautiful to the practitioner. Consider, on the one hand, the petty professional rivalries, the computers that can't calculate the quantity you want, the clever ideas discarded like a child's broken toys, the photons that travel billions of light years only to hit a cloud or fall uselessly to the ground beside your telescope. On the other hand, there is an undeniable grandeur to the universe. For a species only 1,000 generations removed from savagery, many of whose members still live in poverty and misery, humans' goal of understanding the origin of time, space, and matter is audacious indeed. Is the universe beautiful? A cosmologist might blink uncomprehendingly at the question. As George Santayana has said, art critics talk about theories of art, artists talk about where to buy good turpentine. Yet the question is well motivated because a similar aesthetic sense drives both cosmologists and other creative thinkers. As for the issue of how beauty is defined in science, we might start by noting that some aspects of beauty are hardwired, like the attraction felt by a newborn baby for her mother's face. The fact that the universe contains structure also elicits aesthetic appreciation. Physical laws have imprinted patterns in nature that are pleasing to humans, from the reflective planes of a tiny crystal to the soaring peaks of a mountain range to the majesty of a pinwheel galaxy set against the dark velvet of night. It is less clear that beauty can be found from the inchoate disorder of entropy. However, one of the surprises of modern science is that behavior not entirely deducible from initial conditions can arise in a complex system. Patterns can emerge from chaos. It is important not to be too parochial in defining beauty. Proportion and harmony are features of creative works as diverse as Shakespeare's King Lear, Beethoven's Missa Solemnis, and James Joyce's Ulysses. The aesthetic does not have to be classical. The same is true for a play by Tom Stoppard, or a Beatles ballad, or a novel by Martin Amis. Beauty in proportion and form is scale-free. It can be found equally well in a haiku, or an epic poem, a short story, or a novel, or in a writer's life work. And with modern creative arts, perhaps the key aesthetic element is truth-telling. Dr. Impey continues, artists will not agree on the definition of beauty, but they may agree on the recognition of beauty based on an emotional response. Scientists have an equally well-formed sense of beauty, but its basis might not be recognizable to those outside the field. The author J.W.N. Sullivan, who wrote influential biographies of Newton and Beethoven, has written, "Since the primary object of the scientific theory is to express the harmonies which are found to exist in nature, we see at once that these theories must have an aesthetic value. The measure of the success of a scientific theory is, in fact, a measure of its aesthetic value, since it is a measure of the extent to which it has introduced harmony in what was before chaos." The physics Nobel laureate and astrophysicist S. Chandrasekhar believed that Einstein's general theory of relativity is the most beautiful creation of human thought. Einstein himself wrote at the end of his first paper on the subject, "Scarcely anyone who fully comprehends the theory can escape from its magic." The insight of the great scientist carries with it the same flavor of revelation as the creation of an artist. Listen to physicist Werner Heisenberg describing his discovery of the rules of quantum mechanics. "It was almost 3 o'clock in the morning before the final results of my computation lay before me. The energy principle had held for all terms, and I could no longer doubt the mathematical coherence and consistency of the kind of quantum mechanics to which my calculations point. At first, I was deeply alarmed. I had the feeling that, through the surface of atomic phenomena, I was looking at a strangely beautiful interior, and felt almost giddy at the thought that I now had to probe this wealth of mathematical structure nature had so generously spread out before me. I was too excited to sleep." Words of physicist Werner Heisenberg. Dr. Impey continues, Like Robinson Crusoe, we find ourselves on an island in uncharted seas. In the gulfs of time and space that we have explored with telescopes, humans are insignificant and science seems frail. Perhaps, though, we are psychologically wired to seek order and beauty, to listen to the gently magnificent symphony of mathematics surrounding us and threaded throughout reality. That from an essay titled Truth and Beauty in Cosmology, and it's by Dr. Chris Impey, writing in Mercury, January-February 2004. Dr. Chris Impey is a university distinguished professor and deputy head of the Department of Astronomy at the University of Arizona. He has over 170 refereed publications on observational cosmology, galaxies, and quasars, and his research has been supported by grants from NASA and the National Science Foundation. Dr. Impey is a past vice president of the American Astronomical Society, and he has been a National Science Foundation Distinguished Teaching Scholar and the Carnegie Council's Arizona Professor of the Year. He has written over 40 popular articles on cosmology and astrobiology, two introductory textbooks, a novel titled Shadow Worlds, and five popular science books, The Living Cosmos, How It Ends, How It Began, Dreams of Other Worlds, and Humble Before the Void among them. Chris Impey will be one of the featured presenters this year at the gathering at Keystone College in La Plume, July 15th, 16th, and 17th. The theme of the conference this year, innovation, radical dreams for the real world. And Dr. Impey's topic will be our future off Earth. Dr. Impey is currently at the Vatican Observatory. He is one of the distinguished international faculty members at the 2016 Summer School in Astrophysics at the Vatican. And the focus of the summer session in astrophysics this year at the observatory is water in the solar system and beyond. We had a chance to speak by phone with Dr. Impey in Italy about his research, writing, and his summer teaching at the Vatican Observatory.
The topic is time is water in the solar system and beyond. I'm sort of an extraglide cosmology person, so I'm doing water in the rest of the universe and everyone else is doing the solar system.
One of the things that we might think of when we think about an observatory at the Vatican is the sense of how, over the millennia of human experience, our views of the universe have changed and developed and shifted, and how there's been resistance sometimes in religious circles to the developments in science and so forth.
This is a very conducive environment. The Vatican Observatory has about 9 PhD astronomers, so they double wide the PhDs in astronomy and their full-time and their priests with parishes. The Galileo affair was not a good thing, and what made it look like science and religion on a collision course, but if they were trying to keep the calendar, that's hundreds of years, and there's been pretty standard astronomical research using telescopes done in the Vatican for about 150 years.
And you have had an encounter there in that world at the Vatican, but you've also gone off to India to the tops of the mountains and had meetings with Tibetan monks and explored the intersection of science and religion from that aspect as well.
Yeah, and that's a rich dialogue too. I do that almost every year. I'm going back in December, and the monks are very eager students of science. They are well trained in math and physics. They're very skilled in philosophy and rhetoric and logic, so they're really good students. They absorb the information really well.
The title of the book that you wrote about your interaction with the monks is Humble Before the Void. We need to have a sense of questing and curiosity, but humility is important. And also the word void, because you've pointed out to us about how much is vacuum and how much is what we might call empty, but that's so much a part of the universe in which we live.
Yes, and to physics, of course, the vacuum is anything but boring because, ever since quantum theory 100 years ago, it's been known that the vacuum is a place, and just empty space is a place where things can happen. Particles and antiparticles can come into existence. Now we know space can create more space because we live in an accelerating, expanding universe. So vacuum is actually a pretty interesting place. And in Buddhism, of course, the whole idea of a void is, again, it's not a simplistic notion. It's quite a sophisticated set of ideas.
And you have actually brought together not only the hard sciences, but you have a facility for writing fiction as well, and you've raised philosophical issues and written a novel, in fact. Are there things that you can explore better in that format? You wouldn't probably be writing a novel if you didn't feel that way.
Sure, and also, you know, once you get into the frontiers of physics and astrophysics, it gets pretty esoteric, so using a fictional format, you're acknowledging that the science is a little speculative anyway, and then it just gives you a more interesting landscape for conveying ideas that could be pretty dry if you just sort of laid them out. Even in a well-written popular science book, it's hard to talk about the multiverse theory or string theory or things like that.
And you have characters who are all consumed by music. You have a sculptor that you've created. So the arts and science, that's all part of that ability to help us perhaps embrace new understandings of ourselves and the world and the universe we live in,
Definitely. And I'm married to an artist, a portrait, a oil painter, and she's, you know, from a classical basis of portraiture and landscape. She started doing astronomical art, and so we collaborate on these things. And, you know, she can bring a different aesthetic sensibility and a different eye to an astronomical scene. So that's an interesting collaboration. It's a lot of.
And as a little fellow growing up, was your eye always trained on the sky? How did you get drawn into the world and the path you've pursued?
Indirectly, because most astronomers that I know came up one of two paths. They either didn't have a sky growing up and had little telescopes that they traded in for bigger telescopes. So that wasn't my path. The other path was through physics. That was, as you mentioned, London, which where I did my undergraduate physics degree. And astronomy or astrophysics is just sort of the application of physics into the universe. And because the universe is a kind of wild and boundless place, there's a lot of interesting phenomena. So it's a wonderful landscape for exploring physics, because most of the things we've encountered with black holes or accelerating the universe or whatever it might be, you know, sort of billions of habitable worlds, it was very hard to predict these things, just sort of discover them, and then there was a lot to explain.
And the term astrobiology turns up a lot in what we read, referring to some of the things you're thinking about or the programs you've taken part in. What kind of a discipline is that, and what kinds of things are explored in astrobiology?
Yeah, astrobiology is sort of why I'm here, because the water theme at this school really is alluding to astrobiology and the potential for life in other places on the Earth, because water is very abundant in the universe. So astrobiology is, it's a unusually interdisciplinary subject. If you work on exoplanets, you have to know a lot of astronomy, but you also these days have to know geology and atmospheric physics, and if you're going to find life, you have to know some biology too. And so astrobiology meetings are very interdisciplinary and have to be broad, because there's a very big question we're still unanswered.
The news of science makes its way into the headlines often, and perhaps we're not as literate as we should be in terms of science and the news that comes to us. How are we doing as a society in terms of our science literacy?
It could be a lot better. I mean, we have a lot of access to information, not now, with social media and endless connectivity with the world, but science literacy, it really hasn't shifted in the last few decades, and it's pretty low. Most people will get wrong some pretty basic questions about science, and there's argument about how much you really need to know to be a literate citizen. But given the topics that are of world import and in the political arena and being actively debated, like climate change or genetic engineering or any of these things, to be ignorant about the issue means bad choices may be made, bad decisions may be made. So I think science literacy is not just some esoteric thing. It's something that we should be a little concerned about.
And when you come to join us here at the gathering, your topic is our future off Earth. What kinds of questions will you be raising? What kinds of things will you be opening our minds to?
Well, I was drawn to the topic because there felt this tension between on the one hand, the space program was kind of in the doldrums, the human space program, in the sense that we hadn't been back to the moon for almost half a century and we're not really interested in doing it. And America hasn't been able to put an astronaut in orbit for 5 years, so the shuttle's been retired. Nobody likes the space station that much, and it's very expensive, and it didn't seem like things were going that well. On the other hand, there's this private space industry that has some very high-profile names attached to it, like Richard Branson, but it's actually pretty big. There's something like 20 private space companies all trying to do some variation on tourism or getting people eventually to the moon or Mars or mining asteroids, and that seems to be doing very well, and it's growing rapidly. So that landscape was interesting to me, so I wanted to just talk about where we are in that path and in a very historical sense, where do we sit and what it's going to look like 20 years from now.
Dr. Chris Impey, a University Distinguished Professor and Deputy Head of the Department of Astronomy at the University of Arizona. He is right now one of the international faculty members at the 2016 Vatican Observatory Summer School in Astrophysics, where the focus is water in the solar system and beyond. We spoke with him in Italy. Dr. Impey will be one of the featured presenters this year at the gathering at Keystone College in La Plume, July 15th, 16th, and 17th. The theme of the conference this year, innovation, radical dreams for the real world. The folks at Keystone have assembled writers, artists, scientists, philosophers, and entrepreneurs who have broken through established ways of thinking to change the world in ways that are large and small. The aim of Radical Dreams for the New World is to inspire and challenge participants to break new ground in their own creative lives, featuring presentations by Martine Rothblatt, a scientist, entrepreneur, and author, Dr. Impey, Pamela Munoz-Ryan, who is an award-winning author of novels for young readers, James Beckett, who is a filmmaker and environmentalist, Gail Carson Levine, who is an award-winning children's author and a poet, Jason P. Vest, who is a science fiction expert and a professor. All of these people and many workshop presenters will be on hand to exchange ideas and conversations about innovation and about dreaming radical dreams for the world here and now. The gathering at Keystone in its 10th anniversary, and if you need more information, it's thegatheringatkeystone.org, thegatheringatkeystone.org. The dates again, July 15th, 16th, and 17th. At Keystone College in La Plume. They'd love it if you could attend for the entire conference. There are accommodations for you to stay on campus and take part in the after-hours discussions, which are often so rich. And also, you may attend sections of the conference, depending on your own schedule. For all the details, all the workshops, the themes, the reading list, everything is online at thegatheringatkeystone.org. thegatheringatkeystone.org, and that's July 15th, 16th, and 17th at Keystone College in La Plume, the 10th anniversary for this conference that features writers, artists, scientists, philosophers, and entrepreneurs circling around and investigating the theme Innovation, Radical Dreams for the Real World. Again, on the web, thegatheringatkeystone.org.